This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome once more to beautiful, independent Hoho Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. To the hard-traveling L-shaped studios, we hope you've enjoyed Canadian Independence Day. I'm Greg Phillips.
I thought it was Canadian Thanksgiving.
Canadian Thanksgiving. Same thing. Ultimately, what's the difference? Independence Day, Thanksgiving. Folks, what I'm saying is there was a major Canadian holiday this week, and we hope you celebrated it the same way that we did. And and that's by gathering here at a studio to record a podcast. So, Nick, Duke, my fellow compatriot, which is what compatriot means. What is it like to be one of us, the hard-traveling fanboys? How are you feeling on this fine whatever day we're recording this?
It's fine. Your intro is certainly a unique situation this evening, so it portends positive things for the show.
Well, quite frankly, there's not much positive that will come from the discussion about the topic that we're discussing today. But nonetheless, as many of you know, we are, what are we, 2-3 weeks in now to Walking Dead Month right here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We have been doing this since we started this podcast way back in the olden times of 2016. Ironically, Nick, the very first, the last major WWE draft was held at that time, and we had our first Walking Dead month. Isn't that a coincidence? No, not at all. Fair enough. Well, what we're here to talk about today is the negative side of The Walking Dead, and I feel bad about that because we were pretty negative in our season premiere review for this year, although I've heard that the second episode was an improvement, but I'll see that later on. And we're going to talk about the worst of the worst. Today, we are here to count down the 5 worst episodes in our respective opinions of AMC's The Walking Dead. And to join us for this occasion, we wanted to bring in one of the founding participants in Walking Dead Month here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys, longtime friend of the show, longtime guest of the show. She is the host of a multitude of podcasts in the Jenny Experience. Jimmy Position, sorry, not the Jenny Experience, the Jimi Hendrix Experience as a rock and roll band from the 60s. I got confused. The Jenny Position podcast, she's the host of Talkin' Pop, she's the host of Talkin' WCW, Freak Out Drive-In, etc. Ladies and gentlemen, Jennifer Smith.
Hi, boys. I'm so excited. 3 years that I've been doing this, Walking Dead Month with you guys. And I'm so glad that we're going negative this year. It's about time.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about...
Well, didn't we do worst characters at some point?
We did do worst characters at some point, but we've done the best of the best, too. We've done the good side of The Walking Dead. We did the best characters in The Walking Dead, I think, was our first countdown that we did, which...
We haven't been doing this 4 years, have we?
Yes, we have.
Jesus, so yeah, we've done best episodes, best characters, worst characters. Now here we are at worst episodes, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm. Time to bring a little negativity to the table, as if we don't do that enough already.
No.
So
no, I for one, will not stand for any negativity on these airwaves.
Yes, Positive Nick, they used to call you back in the day.
That's granted, right.
That was about various illnesses.
It was a very creative
diseases,
nickname.
But still. in any event, let's get cracking on this continuation of one of our favorite old traditions, and let's start with our number 5 entry on the worst episodes. And since Jenny is our guest, we're going to start with Mrs. Smith. So what is your selection for the number 5 worst episode in Walking Dead history?
Okay, I don't know if you guys remember, one of the characters that I hate the most on this show is Beth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. I do remember this.
So I'm going to have a couple of Beth episodes on my list.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
My precious
I'm sorry.
Beth.
I know you love her. The bug-eyed bandit lives, but I'm going to start with an episode that I think I can rebook, honestly, and make it good. But it is from season 4, episode 12. It's called Still. It's when Daryl and Beth, because she's never had alcohol before. Mm-hmm. And so she's afraid that she might die without having alcohol, which is valid. I mean, like, this is legitimate. So they go through some country club or some shit. They only find some horseshit booze, and then Daryl takes her to a cabin, and then it has moonshine, apparently. And so they get drunk, they talk, and then they burn the cabin down. So I think all of this can be saved if one or two things happen. Either you replace Beth with Carol. I think this would be a fun episode with Carol, because her and Daryl still have magic. Y'all haven't probably seen the latest episode on the new season, but they still got that magic. I'm just saying.
They've got a great bond.
They really do. They're my favorite pairing to watch on the show still. So if you replace Carol with Beth on this episode, then it does not make my list. Also, if you have them fuck on this episode, then it would not be on my list. Which I know is creepy.
No,
but still.
Because here's the thing. It's not this episode, but I think it's two episodes after this where they have the scene where they're sitting. Maybe it wasn't that episode, but I think it was two episodes later where they're sitting in like this abandoned house or whatever, and they're sitting around, and she says, "Why do you care about me so much? Why do you keep protecting me so much?" And he looks at her and he goes, "You know." And there's this like moment between them. And then, of course, she gets taken by the KKK or whatever.
That is what it is. But anyway, it's really good screen time for Daryl. I really love this with him. It's just with her. It all falls apart for me. I fucking hate this episode.
Well, you know, sorry, Greg. If there's one thing that I've learned from last night on watching wrestling television, it is that sometimes you just need to burn something down.
A she shed.
Yes, burn down a she shed with, and who knows how many furry animals may have been murdered in that building, much like our dear departed Ramblin' Rabbit. So, you know what? I can't argue too vociferously against this. I liked this episode because I was a big Beth fan and I liked her getting a little bit of character development. However, I understand, and it is kind of also indicative of The Walking Dead when it's at its worst, probably, which is when it's really, really boring and nothing's really happening. I like their character building, though, so that's fair. That's fair. I'm used to Beth slander at this point, unfortunately.
You should be.
Well, I'm going to go next with my number 5 episode, which introduced some of my least favorite characters on The Walking Dead. This is episode 10 of season 7, and this is during the show's decline, and this is an episode called New Best Friends. Now, you might ask yourself, what is New Best Friends about? Well, I'll be happy to tell you right now. New Best Friends is about how Rick and his group encounter a new group of survivors out in the wild as they're trying to rally the troops for their impending war against the saviors. And who do they come across in this landscape, this zombie landscape, but a group of people who live in a junkyard, and they're known as the Scavengers, a.k.a. the Trash People. Their leader, Jadis, speaks, along with the rest of them, in a manner of speaking that I can only describe as completely idiotic. For some reason, the fall of civilization causes these people to lose all ability to function like normal human beings. They can no longer talk. They can no longer build houses. They can no longer behave as if they are individuals. They are completely mentally devolved. Jadis is one of the most annoying characters that the show has ever created, in my humble opinion. Ooh. and just provides until, and I will say this later, there are a few episodes near the end of her run where it kind of redeems her a little bit in terms of making her interesting. But this version of Jadis, I hate. I can't stand the trash people. They're boring. By the way, it's not just that part of this episode. The rest of this episode also has nothing at all happening. Characters that I don't care about, like Richard, who probably nobody here even remembers.
Richard.
Shut up, Richard. No, he would make the show great. About the only good thing that happens in this episode is Daryl's relationship with Shiva, the tiger. But no, everything else is just boring bullshit that happens. And the main thrust of this episode is the introduction of, again, a character that almost breaks the show. Because one of the joys of The Walking Dead in the early seasons was the kind of the realism in the face of a zombie apocalypse. Like, these felt like real characters having real relationships. And suddenly you introduce this person who feels like a comic book character. And sometimes that can work. For me, it completely took me out of The Walking Dead almost any time that she and her people appeared. Hated it. More Rick stupid speeches in this episode as well. It says here on the Wikipedia entry, by the way, that Jadis is intrigued and she takes Rick to a high pile of trash. A high pile of trash is what I would call this episode. New best friends. Nick?
Well done, sir. So one of the commonalities between our list thus far is that it seems like we're all picking episodes that heavily showcase characters we don't really care for, or settings we don't really care for, or in my case, a little bit of both, because I'm going to go to season 7 as well, Greg, but I'm going to go to episode 6 of that season, and I'm going to talk about an episode called Swear. This is an episode that does one of those things that The Walking Dead likes to do from time to time, where the entire episode is presented from the point of view of one character in the larger Walking Dead ensemble. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times that can produce outstanding classic episodes. Think about any of the Morgan-focused episodes, really, that have been POV episodes for him, or Daryl or Carol or any of those characters. But when you give Tara her very own point of view episode, and then you take her to the fucking lesbian commune known as Oceanside,
this was an honorable mention for me as well. It almost made it.
This all starts to fall apart. The most interesting thing about Oceanside can be summed up in like 30 seconds. The Saviors fucked them over and took all their weapons. How do they get along without weapons? That's interesting to watch for about 3.5 minutes of screen time. And this was, remember, in season 7, where every episode of The Walking Dead, I'm pretty sure, was roughly the length of an extended edition of Lord of the Rings movie. So about 3 hours. I think this was about a 3-hour episode it clocked in at. And it was just them walking around being sad about not having any men or guns. Not that the guns were a euphemism for penis at all, but, you know, you do what you do.
That is sad, Nick.
It is sad, but Jesus, I don't need to hear about it the entire time.
No, Jesus was, Jesus comes later, I think.
Jesus comes later, or sometimes not at all. But anyway.
Not with the lesbians.
No, when you combine a shitty character, a shitty underdeveloped character like Tara with a shitty, uninteresting setting such as Oceanside, and all these weird characters that and that's another thing about this episode. Because they're introducing you to an entirely new locale, they are bombarding you with new characters, and all of them suck. It's really remarkable how they throw like 15 characters at you and you don't give a shit about any of them. Awful. Absolutely terrible. Swear.
It's a shame. One of the leading reasons why I wasn't sad when Tara got killed off.
Because of her obsession with Oceanside?
No, because they had a character that had promise in the beginning, and they systematically just, they kept throwing her in and not having her mean anything to the main story.
Yeah, and then her role was just to be that person who stood in the back and looked shocked.
She was the team. Like, she was the new team dog, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, very, very shitty episode in my opinion as well. So good selection, Nick, and one that was just outside my purview. Well, Jenny, that brings us back around to you, and let's get to your number 4 episode. Is this the second of our Beth episodes, or will we have to wait for that one?
Yeah, it is the second of the best episodes. But I will say that Tara, towards the end, of course, was getting some sort of leadership role. You know, Maggie had left, and she was trying to fill that role and doing pretty well at it. So, I mean, I think I cared a little bit more about her death than I would have previously, maybe if Maggie hadn't left. But anyway, on this episode, in season 5, episode 4, it's called Slab Town. It's where the KKK had kidnapped Beth. And
it wasn't the KKK.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, you know, they wore white robes. They had a white cross on their vehicle. I mean, come on, put
red cross.
Whatever.
Put same thing. Together. So
I'm saying it's the KKK. Just accept it and move along.
So they take her to this hospital in Atlanta. We're back in Atlanta again, and it's basically just like her trying to deal with being at the hospital. And she's so boring and stupid, and I just kept wishing she would get caught and get murdered, like, even quicker.
Oh,
just
man.
So dumb.
She was trying her best in a bad situation to help out the less fortunate.
Yeah, but she's stupid, so.
Well, so is everybody on this show. Except Eugene.
And not Rick, he's got plans.
Well, we'll get to that
now. Yes, we will.
We'll get to that.
And then she befriends the Noah guy, and then they try to escape, but then he escapes and she doesn't. Like, come on.
You know, I really like that actor a lot, too, that plays Noah, but that character was pretty annoying.
Mm-hmm. So, thus concludes my hatred of Beth in this countdown.
Beth, gone and not missed, apparently.
No, not at all. My favorite episode was when she died, but we're not doing that, so.
If we could redo our favorite episodes, I would just include any episode where Beth sings a song.
So, like, 8 episodes.
Yeah, pretty much, where she sits around the campfire playing her acoustic guitar while they stare longingly at one another all around in a circle, exchanging nods.
Like redneck karaoke?
They're always told to never make noise until it's time for Beth to start singing songs. And it's like, fuck it, bring the walkers on.
No, Beth. Your song will soothe the walkers. Maybe they'll be healed.
I can't tell if that was your Rick or your Herschel.
They really have morphed into one another. Rick, you need to talk to your boy. I'm not even Rick. Who are you talking to? That was like every Herschel would just walk around to people saying, "Rick, you need to talk to your boy."
I'm Tara Herschel. You don't remember?
Who? Well, my next episode, you guys are not going to be shocked that this made my list, because this was an episode that I probably bitched about more than any other human being that's ever lived. I mean, I wasn't alone. The entire internet bitched about it, but I bitched about it a lot. And I'm going to continue to bitch about it some more right now. You see, my number 3 episode... Number 4 episode...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're right. Yep, never mind, I skipped one. My number 4 episode, let me be perfectly clear, my number 4 episode is one that I also bitched about a lot, and one that I made reference to just a minute ago. And it is an episode called First Time Again, the season premiere of season 6. And this is an episode that I have helpfully subtitled, The Fucking Plan.
Rick's Fucking Plan.
Yes.
Is this the one where he plays Mousetrap with the walkers, where they gotta, like, push the giant boulder down the valley?
This is also my number 3.
This is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my fucking life.
We talked a minute ago about how Jadis of the Trash People broke my brain with regards to my cognitive dissonance with this show. This just lit it on fire, like Seth Rollins lighting a playset on fire.
Good God, how many times are you going to reference Seth Rollins setting things on fire tonight?
He's traumatized.
I'm traumatized, Nick. You know what I lost last night? A good and personal friend and hero. And I won't stand for it. Anyway, First Time Again features Rick. Literally, the entire episode is about Rick and his grand plan, which we don't know anything about, by the way. We just start at the beginning of the episode with Rick in mortal peril, and he says, we're gonna have to move the plan up. We're gonna have to do the plan now. And then we get flashbacks showing the town council meeting where people are sitting around arguing about Rick's plan. And really, when I say arguing, mostly it's people sitting around telling Rick that he's right and that he's a good man and trusting him. One guy, I think, stands up and says, hey, do you guys think it's a bad idea that we do this plan that puts all of us in danger and won't work anyway? And everybody instantly shouts this guy down, tells him what an asshole he is, and I'm pretty sure drag him out back and beat him. Because he dared to disagree with Rick and his plan. And Rick is quick to point out, the plan is flawless. You don't question the plan. The plan's strong. Rick and his stupid, as Nick referred to, Rick's plan is the most labyrinthine, complicated piece of crap that I've seen since the XFL draft that I watched earlier today. Nothing makes sense. It's all these complicated shapes and directions and pathways, and you honk a horn 300 miles this way, and a train will drive by 400 miles that way, and in 15 minutes the clock strikes midnight, which sets off a series of boulders rolling down a hill, which will then lead the walkers to follow the boulders into molten hot lava, which will then cause the walkers to turn into stone, where they will stay for the rest of time and distract any other walkers that come by trying to help their brethren break out of the stone. Rick's plan is stupid. And not only is Rick's plan stupid, Rick's plan is selfish. Because in Rick's plan, as I understand it, Rick's going to go off and you know, set the little mousetrap in motion and come back to Alexandria where he can be safe with his friends and family. Daryl and like three other people, their job is to literally make a bunch of noise and drive off on their motorcycles to make the walkers follow them with no plan explained at any point of how the hell they're going to get back. So my understanding is I'm Daryl and Rick's telling me what you're going to do is you're going to ride off and you're going to distract the walkers, hordes, thousands of walkers. And then eventually, hopefully, you'll remember how to get back here through that giant walker horde that you have to get to. All right. Best of luck. Fuck Rick. Piss off, Rick. You deserve to die and I hope you're burning in hell. But he didn't die, did he? No, he's off in a damn helicopter somewhere. But anyway, this is in a nutshell is why I grew to hate Rick so much. His stupid plans, his posturing, his monologues, his pretending to care about what other people in the group think, but not really. And then the other characters being so stupid that they follow along with this plan. And then shock of shocks, guys, the plan doesn't work. I hate this episode, and I never want to watch it again the rest of my life.
You know what fails in the plan? What a single horn blast is! It just tears the whole plan apart.
I didn't
is
plan
what
on
tears
noise.
It.
I thought I didn't, it would be perfectly
I didn't
silent.
Figure in the noise factor.
God, who could have imagined and that?
This is like Wile E. Coyote's like master plan.
Rick got that from the Acme Book of Plans to Destroy.
Yes,
zombies.
He did. The Acme Apocalypse.
Good Lord.
Yeah. And then the whole time you have Morgan in there just like needling Rick.
Yeah.
Like, are you sure this is what you want to do? Like, trying to give him like some deep, like, philosophical contemplation. Like, no, I'm just trying to do this.
Yeah,
like, no, just leave me the fuck alone.
Yeah, I mean, you raised some great points, Morgan, but on the other hand, shut the hell up.
I'm not going to do anything you say ever.
Yeah. Oh, God. What an asshole leader. Rick is like, you know, it was, guys, and this is where I'm going to get some heat on the show. It was Rick digging into his inner Dale from season 2. How is this going to benefit the community? And then posing it up to a vote when anyone dares to dissent from him, acting just aghast that anyone would dare disagree with his sentiment. We can't just let this boy die. Hell, yes, the hell we can. And we should have, but that's another story for another time. Anyway, hate this episode, guys.
Same.
There you are. Moving on to my number 3, I'm going to go from one location and locale that's boring as hell to another. Man, I hated that fucking hospital. That fucking hospital that we saw so much of in, what was it, season 5? Mm-hmm. Season 4, something
five.
Like that?
Yeah.
One of those.
I think it was 5, yeah.
5. And so we would periodically, you know, we'd check in at the hospital every once in a while. And then it came time for the mid-season finale of season 5 when we had to all just have one big old long hospital circle jerk where all the hospital bullshit had to pay off in what, again, felt like a 3-hour episode. And while I'm no great defender of Beth the way that Greg is, or no great hater of Beth the way that Jenny is, I'm neutral on Beth. while Beth to me is a nothing character, you can't take her and drop her in the middle of this god-awful storyline of which she is dependent to be the focal point, mm-hmm. because then the entire storyline is boring and stupid. And then when the end of it is that we trade off this nothing character for an objectively terrible character in the form of Noah. That's essentially what we do. She sacrifices herself for fucking Noah, who no one cares about, and who's dead like three episodes later, as I recall. The whole thing is stupid, and it just calls out the fact that that whole hospital subplot made zero sense. I didn't enjoy any aspect of it. I didn't like Daryl's and Maggie's little overly acted emotional moment at the end when they're carrying dead Beth around. The whole thing is just fucking stupid. The whole thing is just fucking stupid.
Hear, hear.
We've got a bunch of haters. Now, Jenny, you've already said a little bit of your piece on this. Do you have anything else you wanted to say about First Time Again? Because you mentioned that was your number three.
No, that rant, your rant was perfect. You said everything that I was thinking. God, so bad. So bad. And it sucks, too, because it was the first episode of that season. And so you've already waited so long, and your hopes are so high. And then you get just, like you said, they just drop you in the middle of that. And you're just like, what the fuck is this shit?
That was a long off season, too, because we were all like, where are they going to go next? What's the next path now that they found a city to settle down in? We knew that Negan was probably coming. I think that had been leaked out. But, like, It was one of those things, and The Walking Dead has been increasingly guilty of this as the seasons have gone on, of just not doing a great job of making people excited after their first episode. Like, it last year, for instance, it wasn't until the back half of the season that I started really digging the show. This year, or in this particular season, you start out with one of your worst episodes with First Time Again, and you know, that season picked up as it went along. But unfortunately, that was kind of the beginning of the slide in where the show started dragging its feet way too much. But anyway, well, I guess I'll move on to my number three now, which is the episode I was referencing earlier, an episode that I ranted about at the time ad nauseum, and will continue to do. And it's from that same season, season six, which I think was something of a down season for The Walking Dead. And it is actually episode 7 of season 6, and it is called Heads Up. Now, why did this episode make my list? It made it for one simple reason. This started it was not the first time that The Walking Dead had kind of manipulated its audience. They had done it a couple times before this. But this was, to me, the turning point episode where we really saw The Walking Dead almost treat its audience with a level of contempt. And here's what I mean by that. This was the conclusion to what had been one of the biggest controversies among fandom for several episodes. Back in the episode Thank You, Glenn, one of the fan favorite characters in The Walking Dead, it was in the third episode of that season, actually, was... his fate was left in somewhat in question. But the way that the episode was shot, Glenn was left alone, seemingly being devoured by walkers beside a dumpster, which was very much seemingly located on the ground. So people were like, oh my God, they killed Glenn. Or people were like, okay, Glenn might survive this, but how is he going to survive? Or maybe he's going to get out with a bite and get to come home and say goodbye to Maggie and his loved ones. Nobody knew what exactly was going to happen. We're like, what's going to happen here? Is there like a, you know, did somebody come through and save his ass right before he's about to get eaten? It sure looked like he was getting eaten at the end of the episode, Thank You. Well, fast forward to episode 7, Heads Up. And we find out that magically, after he's been knocked off of this dumpster and walkers have surrounded him, somehow he rolls away from the walkers, who were on top of him at the end of the last episode, by the way, and finds enough space to fit directly underneath what I can only refer to, as other fans have, as the magic dumpster. So Glenn finds his magic
dumpster. You're literally the only person I've ever heard call it that.
No, I've heard that before.
Yeah, it's all over fandom, Nick. Look it up. Magic dumpster. It's a thing. So this magic dumpster that finds a way to allow Glenn to perfectly fit underneath it, while none of the walkers, by the way, can reach Glenn, even though he was able to fit in under just perfectly. So none of them could reach him. Glenn then manages to escape, along with the help from the convenient help of Enid, everyone's favorite character, Enid. And Glenn and Enid then share a boring story with one another, and Glenn convinces Enid to help him get back to Alexandria, because they've been doing this really drawn out, like the third time they had done this story where Glenn's missing and Maggie's pining over him, and, you know, their love is going to bring them back together and all this stuff. Well, there's also other bullshit happening in this episode. I don't care about any of that. All that matters is the damn magic dumpster. It was a lazy, cheap, ridiculous out by the writers, and it should have warned us for things that were to come, because most of the problems that people have had in recent seasons with The Walking Dead, I think, can be traced to this episode and can be traced to the cliffhangers that have no satisfying conclusion that came out of this episode. And I can tell you, this was not a satisfying conclusion for me. I would have been fine with Glenn dying here. I would have been fine with almost anything happening except what did. And they put themselves in that role by how they shot that previous scene. This episode annoyed me and angered me and was the first time where I almost quit The Walking Dead. And I kept going. I'm glad I did, because there have been a lot of great episodes since then. But it was close for me. And Nick, you'll remember this. I very nearly stopped watching the show because of this episode, because I was so infuriated at the idea that I waited for four episodes to find a resolution to it, and that was my resolution. Hated it.
Indeed. My number three is, I'm going to go back. I think it's actually the earliest episode on my list, is I'm going to go all the way back to season three. And
oh my.
Yes. Ooh. Yes. I think that's the best season. It is the best season, but it has a heavy focus on one of my least favorite characters. I'm pretty sure this lady was on my bottom five characters countdown whenever we did that. And this episode is called I Ain't a Judas, but in my notes I have written, fucking Andrea can't kill the governor. This is an episode about how Andrea can't kill the governor, strangely enough. This picks up right after the governor has attacked the prison. People are dead. The governor has proven himself for about 10 episodes now to be nothing but a massive dick and a danger to everyone around him. He's not a good dude. Somebody should probably kill him. Hey, Andrea's fucking him. She's real close to him. She could probably kill him, right? Easy. He just murdered a bunch of her friends at the prison. She goes back to the prison to check on everybody, and they're like, hey, Andrea, why don't you go kill the governor? And she's like, no, can't kill the governor. And then she goes back to talk to the governor, and the governor pulls a gun on her because he doesn't trust her anymore, because she went to check on her friends. And after that, she thinks to herself, should I kill the governor? No, not going to kill the governor. Then later on, she's visiting with Carol, and Carol's like, hey, Andrea, you know what would be cool? If you killed the governor. And then later on, they have sex, and as he's sleeping, she pulls out a knife, and she doesn't kill the governor. That's the entire episode. It fucking sucks and illustrates everything wrong with these stupid, idiotic, annoying ass Andrea character.
The governor got that good dick, you see.
Good for him. She could have cut it off.
And he used it as a toy, I suppose. Yep.
Keep it in a fish tank.
Yeah, there you go. No, yeah, well, you know, yeah, Andrea was just the worst at times.
Yeah.
No question.
Just the worst most of the time.
Yeah.
The man literally tells her, if you go check on your friends, I won't consider you part of the community. And then she comes back and he holds guns on her because he's going to, you know, until she gives him useful information, and she still can't kill him. She is just awful.
Now,
she gets everything she deserves in the end.
I mean, I can't blame her. I wouldn't have been able to kill the governor because I would have been thinking of Pappy O'Daniel the whole time. And anybody that would kill Pappy O'Daniel is dead to me, honestly. Well, that's an interesting pick, Nick. It's an interesting choice. I understand your choice. She's a stupid character at times. However, great season. But yes, all right, fair enough.
We're not counting down the worst seasons. We're counting down the worst episodes.
Jenny, your selection. I believe we're up to number two.
Number two, yes. So you referenced this episode in your last rant from season 6, episode 3, where Glenn, it's called Thank You. Mm. It's where Glenn gets under the magic dumpster. We're still dealing with the herds of walkers, which we, it's just like, it's, I mean, I guess it's like a legitimate concern, but like, I really don't care. Like, I really don't care about these giant herds of walkers. And then stupid Nicholas, who I hated anyway.
Oh, the worst.
Yeah. It's like Glenn, one of the best characters, saddled with Nicholas, one of the worst characters. And at least he had the wherewithal to fucking blow his brains out when they got surrounded by the walkers on top of the dumpster. But that was the best part of it. Of that episode. And then Rick is still fucking around with this RV and still trying to do his plan. Like, he's still out there in the wilderness, like, with his plan. Like, just, it's not.
You ever notice how sometimes anymore. Rick will just look off into the distance and ruminate more about his plan? Just think about it.
Well, I mean, like, I'm a classic overthinker, but, like, good God. Like, you're just going to have to, like, just recalibrate.
He's not really thinking about the plan. He's thinking about how great the plan is. It's like, God dang, I came up with a great plan. Man, they're going to love me once they see this plan.
And then I will admit, I was one of the. I'm trying to remember if I knew about how Glenn truly died in the comic books by then. I feel like I probably did know. And so I didn't know if they were trying to swerve us and, like, not stay true to the comic book here. I can't exactly remember that, but I feel like that's right. But that whole, like, I mean, because it looked like he was dead, right? It looked like the zombies were eating him.
Yeah.
So it
And the worst, I'll tell you the annoying part, Jenny, about that. Okay, you could say, well, they're deliberately tricking you, but then the problem is the next episode does not pick up with that shot of them eating him or seeming to.
No,
eat
it
him.
Does the whole.
They're just Morgan they're like
thing.
5 feet away from him when the next episode picks up. It's like, what?
Yeah. And they take his name out of the credits for like 3 episodes.
Yeah, so it gets into that manipulation thing that you talked about. Like, this was the first episode where I felt that.
Yeah.
Like, real hard.
Agreed.
Like, come on, we're not stupid. And this, I think The Walking Dead was still pretty much appointment TV at this point, even 6 seasons in.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, it got lessened quite a bit for me, especially by, like, the next season. But I was still, you know, all in on the show. So it just felt so, I don't know, I just felt betrayed and horrified. It was just not well done at all.
I totally get where you're coming from. And what you said actually leads into that sense of betrayal leads into my next episode, my number 2 episode. Because unbelievably, all the stuff that we're talking about with Glenn in the dumpster and that episode where that happens and the follow-up episode – that was actually in the season where we get introduced to the Saviors, and they become the centerpiece focal point of the show. Unbelievably, fast forward an entire 2 seasons, and we're still in this storyline in season 8. Because we've been promised all of this stuff, all of it's building to something. All of these episodes of people sitting around doing nothing, or episodes of people sitting around getting tortured by this bad guy who's very entertaining, Negan, very well acted. But the problem was there was episodes and episodes of the same thing over and over and over and over and over again for 2.5 seasons. And finally, we get to the big finale, and that's my number 2 episode, season 8, episode 16, titled Wrath. It's the season finale. It's the wrap-up of a 2.5-year-long storyline. Finally, Rick is going to get his hands on Negan, and he's going to kill his ass because Negan has killed Rick's friends. He's beaten their brains out in front of him and his loved ones. He's taken fathers from their children. He's taken husbands from their wives from their husbands.
He's psychologically and emotionally tortured Daryl. He's basically emasculated Rick and forced him to do his bidding for the better part of a year. Mm-hmm. You know, he's held all these people under his thumb.
He has raped women and forced them to become his concubines or die.
But, Greg, you're forgetting, Carl wrote a letter.
Oh, that's right. Carl's stupid-ass fucking letter that didn't even fit Carl's character, by the way.
Nope.
Nope.
That goes out and convinces Rick in the moment, because remember, what's one of the basic rules of writing a hero in fiction is that they follow through on their promises.
Mm-hmm.
What they say means something. Rick, who we've been told ad nauseum from other characters from the beginning of The Walking Dead, is the main character of this show, is the hero of this show, is, quote, a good man, end quote, promises us, the viewers, promises his friends, promises his loved ones at the beginning, I think, of season 7, that he is going to kill Negan. By the end of this whole thing, he is going to kill Negan, and he doubles down on that promise after Carl has died. And what happens in this episode? We get one of the most ridiculous sequences, and this covers a shitload of ground in a show about the zombie apocalypse. We get one of the most ridiculous sequences I've ever seen on the show, where Rick and Negan have this fist fight, this knockdown, drag out fist fight underneath a tree, and
underneath a tree that inexplicably has stained glass windows hanging from it.
And in this fight, Rick, in badass fashion, to the point where I remember watching this and I was like, every boring thing that has happened up to this point is all worth it because of this amazing mm-hmm. moment, where Rick cuts Negan's throat with a razor. Or a knife.
Piece of glass,
whatever the hell it is.
The aforementioned stained glass.
He cuts his throat, and Negan has that look of, oh, shit, he actually did it. He actually did it. He killed my ass. And Negan falls to the ground with blood gushing from his throat, which means you're dead. You've had your throat slit. We don't live with modern medicine anymore. And Rick stands there, and he stares, and he breathes heavily. And he goes, help him. And they go and they fix him. He's not dead. He's had his throat slit in the zombie fucking apocalypse, and he's not dead. And Rick took
pity
on him.
Let me just point out. Carl got shot twice, point blank range.
Yep, true.
And lived.
Yep.
So I'm not. I mean,
he got shot in the eye, no less.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. So Negan survives this encounter. Rick leaves him alive. After everything we've been through, we get a knockout blow, and then Negan taken to zombie apocalypse prison. What the hell is this bullshit?
Mm-mm.
And then you want to talk about manipulating the audience. You want to talk about not following through with promises. You want to talk about being betrayed by the writing team. They have this scene at the end of the episode involving, let me make sure I get it right, Maggie, Jesus, and Daryl. And they meet together, which, by the way, Jesus had no business being there in the first place. They should have killed his ass the minute that he started trying to save the saviors. But anyway, the three of them have a meeting, and they agree in sinister fashion that they're going to hold a coup against Rick because of his stupid decision to let Negan live. And I said, all right, maybe some good can come of this. Spoiler alert, it never happened. The meeting didn't mean a damn thing. It just led to this stupid split community storyline that's lasted the subsequent two seasons. So this episode, to this day, even reading about it on the internet again to remind me of what happened, because damn if I was going to watch it again, just reminded me of how angry it made me, because it was such a letdown. This was supposed to be, for those of us who gave them the benefit of the doubt, this was supposed to be the payoff that we've all waited for years, for two and a half seasons, really 3.5 years of television on this thing. And it led to what? I don't know.
Fuckery.
Nothing. Yes.
This was my number one pick. So
it led to me quitting the show. So
yes,
yeah, it's also my number two pick for the record for all the things Greg just laid out.
So both of you guys, follow up now and tell your piece on it. God.
Well, my thing is, you know, you could just go back, dig through the archives and find our episode where we reviewed this because I went off on it pretty hard as I recall. But like, the Negan thing, which like. On so many levels. One, as Greg said, from a sheer writing perspective, you can't have Rick tell us for 2 years he's going to kill him and then not have him kill him. That's fucking stupid. But also, from the Carl... I mean, the Carl thing cannot be overstated. Like, his reasoning for not wanting to kill Negan and his reasoning for giving his cheesy, forced, we can be better speech at the after not killing Negan is because of this fucking letter that Carl wrote him where Carl was saying... I've realized, Dad, we can all get along. There has to be something that comes after. When Carl has been the most little bloodthirsty son of a bitch walking God's green earth for the better part of 6 seasons, and now all of a sudden on his deathbed, Carl becomes a fucking pacifist and has to convince his dad to let Negan live. But also, throw this in, has there ever been one single example on The Walking Dead of the group having to decide between letting someone live or killing someone, choosing to let them live
and
it working out in their favor?
Nope.
Ever.
Never.
Nope, not a single time. It's the single stupidest thing you can do in the context of this show. Anyone who does that based on the 8 or 7 seasons that preceded it is a fucking idiot. Okay, let's move on to the next thing. The little committee thing that Greg mentioned at the end. Maggie and Daryl, great characters. Great characters who should absolutely justifiably be pissed off at Rick. The problem is, that scene is written like they're the villains.
Yeah.
When really, they're the fucking heroes. So it falls apart. And then you throw in the fact that Jesus is there. Jesus is now going to make this evil plot against Rick. And Jesus has been doing nothing for the better part of 2 seasons. But walking around... being a sanctimonious, self-righteous douche, telling everyone how they should be acting, how they should be feeling, what they should be doing, and now he's going to be in this secret plot. Fucking stupid. Then, let's throw in this that didn't even get touched on. One of the other kind of codas to the end of this episode is Jadis being invited to come and be a part of the community, to leave behind the dump, and being welcomed with open arms. And in her place at the fucking trash heap stays Morgan, who for approximately the 78th time in the show's history has decided he just can't be around people anymore because reasons. So he's going to stay at the trash heap. Everything about this episode is terrible. It is an example of bad writing, bad pacing, and just a misunderstanding of what the audience wants to see. It is the episode that made me quit watching the show, and I have had zero regrets ever since.
But Nick... there has to be something after.
There has to be
something after.
We have to be better. Fucking stupid.
Jenny, say your piece on this.
And one. Now, Greg, you know we're going to get 3 whole movies of Rick and Jade.
Oh, God.
How long?
Because she's on the fucking helicopter.
Yeah. How long before Rick and Jadis become lovers in these 3 movies?
Oh, God. Hopefully, very, very quickly.
Oh. How quickly, just so Michonne can find her and chop her head off.
Yes, those bangs are just irresistible.
I'm no great Michonne fan either, but Jesus Christ, we got to get rid of Jada somehow.
Lord.
So I thought, like, legit after he slit Negan's throat, which I was sad about but also happy about. Like you said, they've been building to it for forever. You need to see him die, and you kind of do see him die. So they try to, like, have both, you know, the beautiful Carl ending and then also all of your bloodthirsty, you know, retribution on Negan just by seeing the throat cut. But I thought Maggie was going to finish it.
Yes.
And I thought that would be legit the way to do it.
I swear to you,
because somebody was holding her back, and I thought she was going to break away and finally kill him, and that's how I wanted it to go. And then, so I couldn't blame her at all for this, quote unquote, heel turn that's not really a heel turn because she's right. Mm-hmm. She is exactly right. And if it would have been me, I would have been, put him in a jail cell, do whatever you want to do with Negan, I would be in there fucking killing him any way I could. I'm just saying.
Absolutely.
Like,
Absolutely.
You should have snuck in there and killed him.
And if that would have happened, maybe that's how you can, if you want, if you're so hell-bent on another divide in the group, which they've done so many times before, they could have easily had Maggie break away, kill Negan there, you get the satisfaction of Negan being wiped out, and then Rick's just horrified. Why'd you do that? That's not what Carl wanted.
And it's like, okay, I get it. The death of your son probably fucked you up quite a bit. But everything about what he wrote was, like you said, just against everything that he had been about for the past couple of years. I mean, we watched him kill people all the time. He was a little bloodthirsty bastard.
He was mad at his dad for not being more bloodthirsty.
Yes, and he had that hat on all the time, and
the implication I always got was that he, in some ways, was taking after Shane. That he had, a little bit of Shane streak in him, and almost resented his dad at times because of that.
Maybe some sort of like epiphany comes to you when you know you're going to die. Yeah. You know, like, and he was like, "I've been wrong this whole time." But
you know what what needed to happen? Michael Caine, as Alfred, needed to show up and take the letter and keep the letter from Rick until Negan was dead.
Mm-hmm.
Or burn. I burned it. I burned the letter. Some things are just left alone.
Because Alfred knows what's best.
He does. He made the right decision in The Dark Knight. And everybody in The Walking Dead made the wrong decision by allowing Rick to read that stupid letter from his dead kid.
And to this day, Negan is still in the fucking jail cell.
Now we're supposed to like him. Now he's supposed to be a good guy. We're just supposed to have forgotten that Glenn's eyeball fell out of his head.
He's not always in the jail cell now. They let him out to pick tomatoes or whatever.
That's right. Yeah, you're right. He gets to farm like Herschel.
It's leading to him.
Everyone in The Walking Dead gets their period of peaceful farming.
And it's clearly leading to him being let out, right? We're just going to forget the fact that Glenn's eyeball fell out of his skull.
I'm so glad I'm not watching anymore. Like, that's just as great as that character is, and as much fun as he can be.
And Jeffrey Dean Morgan's amazing, no question.
Narratively, it makes no sense. Unless literally every person
who was in the original
who was around
movie.
Was dead somehow.
Like, if it was just Judith, it would make sense that why Judith said, "This guy isn't that bad," you know. I could see that, but anyway, gosh.
I want him and Alpha to have the show now. That's what I want
now. I think they might. I haven't read that far in the comics, but I think I read that there is an Alpha versus Negan showdown in the comic.
That's the good shit right
there. That would be good. That would be good. Although now I kind of want Carol to be the one that gets the big confrontation with Alpha, but we'll see if that happens. All right.
How many times between now and then will Carol decide she can't be around people?
She already tried to get Daryl to run away with her on the boat.
You guys were referencing the most recent episode, so I assume she's already changed back and forth a couple of times just in the course of that episode.
Yep.
I haven't seen episode 2 yet, but I'm going to be watching it probably this weekend, so...
she and Morgan are like the people seesaw. When one is with people, the other one's up in the air, and then they just go back and forth.
It's weird because I felt they had a little bit of a connection at one time, and it never really went anywhere, but they are very similar in that way. Well,
I want Carol and Daryl to ride off, and let's do a show about them.
I would watch that. I mean, that's a spinoff. I've been saying that for a long time. There have been so many spinoffs they could have done with Daryl. Daryl and Merle. They could have done. Daryl and Carol going off together. Or hell, I still like my idea of Daryl and Eugene doing a wacky tag partners who hate each other and go on the road together.
That's the one thing about this episode that is good is this whole time you thought that Eugene was working for Negan. Well, he was, but he was sabotaging all their weapons. So you finally got to see that happen. Mm-hmm. In this episode.
The build-up to the fight was not bad. The build-up to the fight had some cool moments. And that's why it was so disappointing when the fight finally happens and it plays out the way that it does. Really unfortunate. But, Nick, it's time to get on to both of our number one episode on this list. It's an episode titled After, but that doesn't
mean anything. I don't know what the fuck it's called. That's irrelevant. This episode is called Pudding.
It's called Pudding. Season 4, Episode 9. It is the mid-season premiere of season 4.
It's known as the first of a two-part episode. The sequel was released many years later, and it was called Roller Skating, I think. but the first installment is called Pudding.
And it's not putting on the Ritz. It's just pudding, the kind that you eat. Because
pudding.
Chocolate pudding. Which was the nickname of one of my friends in high school, actually. We all called him Chocolate Pudding. But that's another story for another time.
Was he an African-American individual?
I was going to ask that, too.
I'm not allowed to comment on that. Yes,
you're not allowed to comment on whether or not the man was African-American?
Yes, he was. I shan't reveal the reason why he was called Chocolate Pudding in our friends group. But
he stuck his dick in chocolate pudding, didn't he? Your silence tells all. Grant, thank you. Continue.
I would let one of my my other friends would tell it better, but yes. So the episode here is indeed, as we are talking about, it really the high point of the episode is Carl eating pudding. You see, this picks up in the aftermath of the big brouhaha against the governor. They've lost the prison. The core group of characters have spread into the four winds, all in different groups. And Rick and Carl are on the road, and Rick is hurting. He's got a concussion. He's bleeding. You know, he's damaged. And Carl is with him, and they're, you know, Rick thinks that he's lost his daughter Judith forever, and Michonne is also off there around there somewhere as well, and they end up in this house. And this is an episode that is basically Carl being the most belligerent asshole son that has ever lived. He just berates his dad. Now, don't get me wrong. His dad's acting like an idiot too, but his dad did just potentially lose a child.
And Rick is like mortally wounded, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, he's really
mortally
injured.
Wounded. And Carl just acts like a little shit the whole episode. Oh, and by the way, nothing happens. They go to a house, and Rick lays on a couch, and Carl sits there berating him. And then Carl goes outside and gets – imagine this now. Carl goes outside and gets himself in trouble. Hadn't seen that before. And eventually, he sits on a roof and eats canned chocolate pudding.
For about 25 minutes.
Yes. As I recall, this episode – let me see what the runtime is in this episode. Should tell me here.
I believe it's 2 hours, 29 minutes.
Yes, and of that 2 hours and 29 minutes, 1 hour and 75 minutes, which is, I don't know why I would say that.
I'm good with it. An hour and 75 minutes
yep, is Carl eating pudding. Sitting there eating pudding with his hair flying back in the wind.
So I have this is my theory, and it's not really a theory so much as I think this is pretty obvious to anyone who paid attention to such things. I think The Walking Dead is kind of like Stephen King. When Stephen King first got started, people would do this really cool thing called editing, where they would take stuff out of his books and they would try to make them better. And The Walking Dead, for the first two seasons, I think they had a runtime, an actual concrete runtime, and they would have to, I know this sounds crazy, take things out of the episodes to fit the runtime.
Yes.
And then at a certain point when the show became so popular, AMC just said, do whatever the fuck you want. Make them an hour and 40 minutes if you want to. And I think for the most part, those episodes are the worst for the extended runtime. It doesn't mean that the episodes can't be good in spite of the extended runtime, but there's a lot of these most of these episodes you look at, and there's so much extraneous bullshit that could easily be cut out of these episodes to get them into that one-hour time frame. And this one, this what does it say? Runtime. Where's the runtime for this? I'm preparing to call bullshit if it says anything under an hour. I don't know what the runtime is on this, but it just feels like something that could have been greatly enhanced by someone daring to go through the script and say, you know, do we really need pages and pages of Carl just walking around silently and then eating pudding? Probably not. But like Greg said, the problem is not just the pacing. It's the fact that Carl is being the biggest dick on the face of the planet for the entirety of the episode, and then the back half of the episode is built around us. We're supposed to you know, feel good that Carl is getting to have a feel good moment that reminds him of how things used to be before when he's eating this pudding. We're not going to feel good about Carl getting good things after he's been a dick for three seasons and the biggest dick in the world, especially in this episode. Fuck that. This episode in particular illustrates why Carl was far and away the worst character on the show, and he deserved a much more brutal death than he got.
He wasn't the worst character on
the show. He was easily the worst character. Not even close.
This was the worst episode, though, to me.
Name a character worse.
Lori.
No.
Andrea.
No.
Jadis.
All of these characters that you're mentioning were around. Let's see. Lori died in season two? Season three. Lori dies in season three. Andrea dies in season three. Carl lasted seven fucking seasons, Greg. Well, 7 years of the same bullshit over and over.
He was fine.
7 years of Carl and his stupid hair and his stupid hat. 7 years of Carl getting shot every other episode and somehow living to tell the tale.
I never get tired of a Carl rant.
We thought we were past the Carl rant.
We did, but we just bring him back all these memories.
Worst of all time. There was never anything redeeming about his character. He didn't take one action that ever made the show more interesting. Mm. Ever.
Even in his death, he ruined the coolest thing that could have happened.
In his death, they gave him like the most boring anticlimactic death of all time. We needed like him getting eviscerated by like a thousand walkers or whatever. We needed John Rambo to show up, stand on the back of a, you know, with a machine, a Jeep mounted machine gun, and literally disintegrate Carl before our eyes. No, he just laid there and died. It was the stupidest fucking thing.
He just laid there and died.
Mm. He couldn't even find a way to die in an entertaining fashion. That tells
his
you how
much death
it
was
sucked.
A good episode, Nick. It was a
it
good
wasn't.
Episode.
It wasn't a good episode because it was badly written. Because again, it's Carl not acting like Carl, and all of a sudden the writers
just
say
he was about to die.
Because conveniently they want to use Carl for something that he's never been. Because they want to hit their magic fucking Walking Dead writers button that they like to do because they're bad writers and they're lazy.
Well, Jenny, do you have anything to add? Do you have you've already talked about your number one, right?
Y'all stole that one. I remember this episode, and I also remember actually liking the comic book part. When I was reading this, and I remember reading this part of the book, I actually liked it in the book. But then I didn't like this episode, and it wasn't about pudding, really. I think it was everything post prison, like, because I liked them in the prison.
I
liked them settled there.
I think,
you know,
that was
and
the
then
best stretch of the episode was season three and four, were the first half.
The show has been downhill ever since they left the
prison. Yeah, so it was coming down off that, like, all of that promise that I had felt for the prison, and then all of it being destroyed, and then, you know, everybody scattered. I don't like it when everybody's scattered. It drives me insane. I don't like it when they're not together. And so them being off on their own was not ideal. But I did like it when Michonne showed up at the end.
Yes, that's fair. That's fair. Michonne's good. Well, I did want to mention some honorable mentions here that came dangerously close to making my list of the worst episodes. The first one that was actually – I originally had my number six was What Comes After, which is Season 9, Episode 5. And this is the Death of Rick episode, which you would think I would love because Rick was being killed off and he had been my least favorite character for a long time on the show. But it wasn't good, no, because instead of being good and entertaining, it's Rick having lucid dreams about all the people he's loved over the years that have been killed, and then fantasizing throughout the episode about the future and how it might look with Negan picking tomatoes in a garden with all of his grown-up children now. And it was just, you know, pretentious bullshit. Another one that almost made my list was Vatos, all the way back in season one, mm-hmm. episode four, where we talk, again, it's the cognitive dissonance thing. So we run into suspension of disbelief, rather. We run into a group of Latino street gang members who also take care of old people in a nursing home.
That is a tremendous episode. Season one is like untouchable for me. Like, I love season one, hands down. But I like those. I like
episode out of season one.
No, I like those Latino guys, and they're taking care of our old. And it was just different. It was sweet, and it was some needed humanity in the chaos that was the beginning part of the apocalypse.
What you actually didn't realize at the time was that in the background there at the nursing home, some of the patients were actually recording an episode of Year in Pop, I believe.
Yes, they were.
Oh, boy.
1958.
Well, Gladys, these young Latino boys are sure taking good care of us so that the zombies don't attack us. I haven't seen anything this frightening since Bob Hope's fourth special.
Have you mentioned who the fuck is Morales yet?
No, but I'm about to.
Okay.
Who?
That was almost on my list.
I don't remember the episode name is the problem. I deleted it either. But Rick runs the episode where Rick is confronted at the end of the episode by a guy holding a gun to him, and Rick turns and looks at the guy. At the end of the episode, the last part, line of the episode is Rick saying, "I know you. You're Morales."
Morales. Which, who the fuck is Morales?
I remembered him.
You remembered Morales?
I remembered him.
That
yeah.
guy from that one for that one episode?
From season one, yeah.
I guess that's because season one is so high on your list.
Yeah, I mean, I know those episodes. So,
I had another episode called The Damned that almost made it from season eight. And I don't remember anything about it except that I wrote down in my notes, The Damned. As a contender. Oh, this was the Morales episode. Okay, yes. Okay, then I had another one that I put on here just because of the title, because the title made me angry, and it was The King, The Widow, and Rick, which was season 8, episode 6. And then the other one was The Key, which is where they meet this lady that apparently has this utopian community that she's lived in this whole time that we've never heard about.
Oh, Georgie.
Georgie, and gives a book to Maggie, and the book has the secret to their new success, and then she vanishes and is never heard from again.
Yeah, they can build
off-screen
windmills and shit, right?
Yeah.
With the blueprints or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't remember the names of them, but I remember, like, it was from, I think, season – so what would have been right after Terminus? Season 5?
Because
they
yes.
break out of Terminus like season premiere of season 5.
Oh yeah, the mm-hmm. season the Terminus thing lasts so short. They're in Terminus yeah. like two episodes, and then it's
the road to Terminus is very long, but Terminus itself very short. Mm-hmm. So I think season 5 then, whatever the Gabriel focused episodes were,
oh,
I had like
yes.
virtually
Ooh.
Every one of those written down
yes.
as like a yeah. contender of like Gabriel doing bullshit at the church. Mm-hmm. Gabriel doing more bullshit.
And let me tell you, the only thing that kept it off my list, one of those episodes in particular, would have made my list, except it was the episode where the Terminus guys eat Bob's leg. And then
yes.
Bob
Eric
says,
Wallace's leg.
Yeah, tainted meat! Mm-hmm. One of the great lines.
Yep.
Now
what I want to know is, how is he going to kick the football now if his leg...
He ain't.
He was a great character. Bob was awesome. One of my favorite characters.
Derek Wallace was indeed a great character.
You and Derek Wallace. Well, I also wanted to mention that one of the interesting things I was doing research for this show, trying to put together my list of episodes, Wikipedia's episode entries list the millions of U.S. viewers that watch The Walking Dead. And it is fascinating to watch the decline of this show.
Yes.
Jenny, you mentioned it earlier as appointment television. Not that long ago, by the way.
No.
Because the peak of the show ratings-wise consistently was around – it was going up and up and up and up and up through season 5. And then mm-hmm. it started to taper a little bit. Season 6, it was up and down a little bit, but it started trending up near the end for the Negan
right.
premiere. And then, of course, there was that big cliffhanger. Who did Negan kill through that off-season? The season 8 premiere of season 7 premiere of The Walking Dead, The Day Will Come When You Won't Be, which was going to reveal who Negan's victim or victims were, drew a series record at that time, 17.03 million viewers. Mm. 17 million people watched this episode. The very next episode dropped to 12.4 million, and then it was pretty consistent throughout. But fast forward just 2 seasons after this, and what are our ratings for this premiere of season 10? 4 million viewers, U.S.
Wow.
They have lost from that season premiere. Now, I know the average is lower than that, but from that peak of that season premiere, they have lost 13 million viewers in the course of just 2. This was 2016, by the way, October, when that episode aired. I mean, it is shocking how far this show has dropped in terms of just people talking about it and watching it live.
It's, I mean, 10 years is a long time for something like this.
And it's really hard for anyone to maintain.
But, I mean, as we said, the show has kind of progressively, again, you guys are watching and I'm not now, so I mean, I can't speak to it with any sort of recent information, but I, as someone who was enjoying the show as late as season 6/7, acknowledge the fact that, like, post-prison, it was a steady decline that then became much more rapid as it got into seasons, the late stages of season 7 and then season 8. And so you can't just, like, continue to give your audience diminishing returns and anticipate it having an effect on your viewership. I mean, look at wrestling, for God's sake.
Yeah, it's been fascinating. It was fascinating to watch, and it kind of put into perspective, like, you know, just the speed with which it happened, because Walking Dead was a show that always had a steady audience, and it had built that even on its lesser seasons. It had built
the Negan cliffhanger really pissed a lot of people.
It
really did, and I think that was probably the biggest mistake they've ever made.
Yep.
And then coming back in the fashion that they did, and like killing off Glenn and then Abraham. I mean, like when you pull a cliffhanger of that fashion, you're gonna lose a lot of people anyway. So that when you come back, you need to give them something that makes them feel good about still watching the show. And instead, they just gave us more Bleak, which, you know, I was fine with at the time. But man, it turned a lot of people off, and it's never really recovered from that, I would say.
Yeah, I think the Walking Dead has always been a show that has been relentlessly bleak, and that's kind of the unspoken contract you sign when you become a viewer. However, even in and I think you guys might understand what I'm talking about here. Even in the midst of unrelenting bleakness, you got to have hope spots, as you put it, Nick. You have to have glimmers that things could be okay. You have to have moments of happiness mixed in with the darkness and the sadness. And they just – it feels like Walking Dead, as it's progressed, has gotten more and more aggressively grim. And you know, like, where is the joy to be had? That's why last year, Jenny, I think you agreed with me when we talked about this. When they did that flash forward, it was such a breath of fresh air to me, because character of Judith in particular was a shot of optimism in a show that felt like it had been beating me down as a viewer for 5 years of everything bad happening in the world. To quote Josh Brolin in True Grit, everything's against me. And that's how it feels at sad times watching The Walking Dead. So it was nice to get these sort of this new perspective with these fresh characters. But yeah, I think that relentless bleakness kind of adds up over time.
You know, in this last episode, Judith was telling a story about the brave man, or whatever she called Rick, to her little brother, and, you know, it was a sweet story and everything. And I just could not help thinking, Shane is your daddy, and you don't even know him. Like, this is all just like made up bullshit. You know what I mean? Like, legitimately, does she even know Lori? Does anybody talk to her about her mother? Probably not.
No, she thinks of Michelle as her mom now.
Yeah, I know. And I don't know. It's just,
They do. They just make sure they tell her how terrible Lori was.
Yeah. Your mother was your the dirt sucked. Worst.
Yeah.
Your mother was the dirt too. Worst, and her, your brother was even worse. And so you're probably going to turn out to be pretty awful yourself.
God. Good Lord.
There's some optimism for you.
Dude, it's great.
She is pretty great. You know,
she's been through a lot, too, because she spent like 5 years at the exact same age.
Yes, she was an infant for a very long time.
Very long time. And now she's not an infant anymore. She skipped all the years in between. So,
but she gets to fight zombies. You know, she's what is she now? What, like eight? Yeah, seven?
Like eight, probably. I'd say eight.
You know, she gets to do basically whatever she wants. You know, she can go fight zombies. She has weapons. She has Carl's hat. You know, she's got to get shot in the face.
You got Carl's hat. What the hell else do you need? If you can get the governor's eye patch,
probably,
to go with Carl's eye patch, you can just cover both your eyes. What a great look that would be. Anyway, we're gonna bring this thing to a close. And before we do, I want to give Jenny a chance to tell you you, the audience, where you can find her, not where she can find you. On social media, Jenny, and also whatever shows you would like to promote and advertise.
Well, I just wanted to mention the Jenny Position, which is my feed, which has my shows on it, like Geek and Sassy, Freak Out Driving, Talking Pop, other stuff. And we just had an episode drop today of Talking Pop, which me and Tim talked to Scott Criscolo about VH90210. So that was a fun episode.
Yes, and I watched the premiere and I watched the last episode, so I haven't watched the middle episodes yet.
You got to watch the middle episodes and then listen to that podcast because it's pretty fun. And then I have a couple of shows coming up here on the Pop feed too. One with Andy and another one with Scott. And I think we're going to be doing that that watch along too that you guys probably won't do. But from the summer movie.
Oh, the summer movie watch along. Yeah, no, I don't have time. There's no time anymore with wrestling coming up.
Summer movie watch along. I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah. All right. Well, you can find me on Twitter at Jenny Position. So that's it.
Awesome. Excellent stuff there. Be sure to give her the old follow on the Twitter. And I can be found on the Twitter at gphillips8652, where you get all of my exciting takes on the worlds of wrestling and comics and sports on occasion and nothing else really. And Nick, you can be found at NickDuke87 on Twitter as well. And we want to invite you to join Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page where you go and there's stuff on there. And anyway, if you want
usually actually it's pretty dead most of the time. But
yeah, occasionally when I remember to promote our show, there might be something there, but otherwise not much. But yes, please go there and spark the conversation. We got a lot of fun people there who like to talk about comic books and whatnot especially. So anyway, we thank you, Jenny, for joining us once again for Walking Dead Month. When we come back from the break, we will have big news about Marvel Comics. We will have a little bit of the bubbly with regards to wrestling, and
I must say, a very special edition of JR tonight. So make sure you stick around to the back half.
It's not
going to
be that special, folks. I can promise you that.
It's gonna be special.
In any event, we hope you stay.
I think JR is going to take a DNA test tonight. Is all I'm.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, my God. Yes. This is excellent news.
Why do I do this to
I'm
myself?
I'm so happy.
What does who do what?
What I meant is, why do we do this to good old JR, who's a wrestling, a WWE Hall of Famer,
We're helping him engage with his younger Hall of Fame. His younger fans.
Dan Hodge think if he were tuning into this show? My God.
Dan Hodge. I don't know what he would think, honestly.
Say something. You're about to say something negative about Dan Hodge. I could feel it. You were going to make an anti-old Dan Hodge. I could feel it coming. Anyway.
Dan Hodge is still alive, right?
Yes, he is still alive. He can still crush an apple with his hand.
He could break pliers with his bare hands.
You don't want to get a hand job from Danny Hodge. That's what I'm saying. A Hodge job. Yeah.
Anyway, we will be right back after these messages.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. We are back with our weekly look, actually, at the news and notes in the world of comic books. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a segment known the world over as The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown.
My goodness, Nick. Big news. We promised it before the break. We promised it right before the break, in fact. Big news in the world of Marvel Comics. The world of Marvel Entertainment, indeed. Because Kevin Feige's power just keeps growing. You might say that he's got his hands right now on the Infinity Gauntlet. Because under a new deal with Marvel, the various divisions have been restructured, and Kevin Feige will now oversee much more than just the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Marvel TV, Marvel Family Entertainment, the animation division, and much of Marvel Comics are reportedly being moved under the Marvel Studios banner, with Marvel Entertainment being led by Ike Perlmutter, when retaining control of publishing operations, sales, creative services, games, licensing, and events. But Feige is the new chief creative officer of Marvel as a whole, which really should have been the lead, but Newsarama sucks at these things. Marvel's longstanding chief creative officer, Joe Quesada, will still be with the company. However, Feige is where the buck stops, really, ultimately, with most of their creative decisions now. Nick, first of all, what do you think this really means ultimately? Will it have any impact? And number two, what are your personal thoughts on this? I know neither one of us are reading much in the way of monthly Marvel comics or comics of any kind at this point, but what are your thoughts on this move in general?
I'm in favor of it. I'm in favor of it for these reasons. I think a lot of people today are overreacting to the idea that he's the chief creative officer of Marvel and are directly assuming that means he's going to be in the weeds affecting comic book storylines. What this is, and I mean, I think a lot of the stories that have been written by even Deadline and the Hollywood Reporter and a couple other places, they're putting these things in the proper order of operations. They are mentioning first, this means that Marvel Animation and Marvel Television are going to fall under his more direct supervision, and then eventually they kind of mention comics. Rich Johnston over at Bleeding Cool, and yes, you can take Bleeding Cool for whatever you want. I know it's not the most reliable thing on the face of the planet, but they have had some decent reporting in years past, has published kind of a follow-up to this that I read right before we started this podcast, and he's saying his understanding is that Joe Quesada is going to kind of continue in the role that Joe Quesada has been fulfilling for some years now, because Joe Quesada was the former chief creative officer, but Joe Quesada had no influence whatsoever on Marvel film. That was Kevin Feige's baby. Joe Quesada now will be reporting directly to Kevin Feige. And Rich kind of says his understanding of it is that Feige's going to kind of let comics continue to do what comics have been doing, and he's going to focus on, again, Marvel film and then television and animation. And then what we'll probably see is pretty much every project that Marvel puts out now on the TV side, whether it be live action or animation, will have some sort of MCU tie, that we will finally be getting that televised version of the MCU that we were promised so many years ago with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. never really came to fruition because of the varying corporate structures and creative structures that Marvel had going on. So from that standpoint, I like it.
What about the comic standpoint?
The comic standpoint, again, if what Rich is saying is true, Feige is going to kind of let comics be comics. Mm-hmm. It's not really going to have that much of an impact. And anything that reduces the influence of Ike Perlmutter can only be a good thing at this point. So, yes. Comics-wise, I don't know that this really matters all that much.
Yes, I would tend to agree. Feige...
Yeah, people who are saying, oh, now the MCU will just take over the comics, I don't think that's going to be the case.
Yeah, I don't think so either. They're different entities, and I still think that in some cases the comics could take some cues from the MCU. Simplicity of storytelling, commitment to character, resistance to do lame, cheap stunts. Some things to learn, perhaps, from the MCU. So, yeah, I don't think this is a bad thing at all. I think good for Kevin Feige. He's earned his position. I don't think that he is beyond reproach like many feel, but he'll eventually screw up. But so far, he's done a great job. So, more power to him, literally. Speaking of Kevin Feige, a project that he was apparently involved in some ancillary way in was Venom. And Venom is having a sequel developed. Not filming yet. But planning to release, believe it or not, in October of 2020, which I can't understand how they would hit that deadline. But nonetheless, we have a second villain for the movie in addition to Woody Harrelson's Cletus Cassidy. We are going to be getting the character of Shriek, who was the main squeeze of Cletus Cassidy during the Maximum Carnage storyline from 1993 that any child of the 90s might remember. She is a mutant with powers connected to the Dark Force dimension. So, you know, she's tied in loosely to Cloak and Dagger and their continuity, but that's neither here nor there. And loves her some Cletus Cassidy. So Venom adding to the pantheon here.
Yes, we really need Eddie Murphy to make a cameo in Venom 2, just to call out Cletus there for a moment. But I'm excited about this. You know how, you know, little come on Cletus action.
Come on.
Would be good.
Cletus.
Coming to America 2 is going to be PG-13, by the way, which is bullshit. Sorry, that's a random aside. I'm excited for Venom 2. I know that we have good friends. Todd Weber and Russell Sellers, who were very angry with Sony a few weeks ago and were bitching at us for enjoying Venom and blaming us for the state of Spider-Man negotiations and all that kind of stuff. But Venom was fun, man. It was a dumb, fun movie that, based on that post-credit scene, is about to go from dumb fun to the stupidest amount of fun that could possibly exist. So I'm for this. I would think, in all seriousness, that this Shriek deal is probably laying the groundwork for the eventual Spidey and Venom crossover that I'm assuming will wind up being an adaptation of Maximum Carnage.
Who would you book in your ideal, if you had all the power, who would you book as Shriek in this movie?
Joan Jett.
Oh my God.
She kind of looks like Shriek, doesn't she?
A little bit. I was just thinking of what actress could be just as over the top and funny as Woody Harrelson in this.
Oh, role. That's a good point. But it's got to be a female. Yeah, so
that's why I said actress.
I thought you said actors. Oh, over the top and funny is and a little, you know, Shriek. Oh, I don't know, Greg. That's a tough one.
Yeah, I don't know. I have to give it some consideration.
I'd say Kristen Wiig, but you hate her.
No, actually, I think this would probably be a good role for Kristen Wiig, actually.
Yeah.
She could probably pull this off.
Remember, she's playing the cheetah, though, which I still can't wrap my head around.
Isn't it weird that that movie feels like so off the radar?
Wonder Woman. And it's coming out. It's coming out in like 8 months.
Yeah, so it's just the presence hasn't been there in terms of. I mean,
I'm sure they're probably going to wait for the after the new year. I think a lot of people, like, here in the next week or so, Star Wars is going to drop its last trailer, and they're going to do the big ticket on sale thing that they've done that always breaks Fandango. So Fandango,
and Tyler depending Breeze, on, you know,
and Tyler Breeze. So I think a lot of people are waiting for the post Star Wars vacuum that will be left to really take advantage of marketing out there, because Star Wars is going to dominate the marketing space here and for probably the next few weeks, pretty soon.
Well, one thing that will be dominating the marketing space in 2020 is going to be The Batman. As this movie continues to build its cast and its crew, Zoe Kravitz, daughter of Lenny Kravitz, has been cast as Selina Kyle, a.k.a. Catwoman, in Warner Brothers' The Batman. This according to The Wrap. The movie will begin filming in January 2020. She voiced Catwoman in the Lego Batman movie. She's also played roles in X-Men First Class and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. She's actually, by the way, the stepdaughter of Jason Momoa, who, of course, is married to her mother, Lisa Bonet, who was on The Cosby Show back in the day, but that's neither here nor there. I like this casting. I don't have a problem with this at all. I don't know much about her as an actress because I haven't seen many of her movies. The only of her movies I think that I've seen may have been, in live action anyway, may have been First Class, where she had kind of a throwaway role. But
who was she in First Class? Was she Angel in First Class?
She was somebody
Class?
Named Tempest, who I don't even remember.
The fuck was that?
Nonetheless.
No, her breakthrough role came as Angel Salvador.
Oh, so her. Then this article is wrong. Unless Angel Salvador's nickname is Tempest. But yeah, she was kind of a throwaway character in that movie. Not much to her. But I've heard she's a really good actress. So I'm good with this casting. No issues here.
Yeah, I don't know anything about her like you, but I mean, we'll see how it works out.
Yeah, I mean, it's a character who's really been done very well. If you think about all the people that have played Catwoman, has there ever really been a bad Catwoman on screen, live action? I can't really remember one.
I wasn't, and this is blasphemous for some in some circles, I wasn't the biggest fan of the Eartha Kitt 66 incarnation, but you know, it is what it is. Maybe it's just because of my, even from a young age, my somewhat unique attachment to Julie Newmar. Good Lord.
Oh boy. Well, in any event, we're going to move on to the next item here, which is the XFL draft. No, I'm just kidding. We are here to talk about...
No, actually, a little sports news, Greg. How do you feel about the Ryan Tannehill era beginning in Tennessee?
Good luck and Godspeed to the Tennessee Titans and my boy Derrick Henry. I hope they realize what they've done. In any event, is Wayne Brady going to have to dig a grave for a bitch? Well, I ask that question for a reason. Wayne Brady, the illustrious, the talented Wayne Brady, has been cast in Black Lightning as a recurring villain, Gravedigger. He'll be playing, oh, this is an awesome name, by the way. He will be playing Tyson Gravedigger Spikes. What a phenomenal name. A World War II era member of the U.S. military who became a super soldier after a secret experiment gifted him with enhanced strength, agility, tactical genius, and hand-to-hand combat expertise. After the war, he defected to the country of Markovia rather than return to a segregated America. Well, I shouldn't say he's a villain. I'm assuming he's a villain. He may not be. But nonetheless, Wayne Brady going to be on Black Lightning. That's pretty damn cool.
That is pretty cool.
Great casting for that show. And speaking of the CW, we cannot let this episode go by without, Nick, yet another Crisis on Infinite Earths update.
This one is – I mean, like, and we say this about every one of them, how cool they are. This one – I'll be honest. I thought the Smallville thing was going to happen all along, really, once they made the initial kind of
rash of casting announcements and you saw how things were going to go, I thought the Smallville thing would eventually wind up happening. This was not even on my radar. Go ahead.
Well, an actor and a character from the Tim Burton Batman movie, 1989,
yes,
will be appearing in Crisis on Infinite Earths. That actor is Robert Wool, and the character is Gotham Globe reporter Alexander Knox.
Yes.
And the outlet Canada Graphs has identified his world as Earth 89. So, what a great and wonderful Easter egg and nod, yes, to the longtime DC Comics fans. This just feels like a love letter to DC.
Yes,
fans,
it really does. There was a set image that was leaked also. I'm going to assume it was probably from this same Earth 89 of like a newspaper that had a headline, billionaire Bruce Wayne to wed Selina Kyle or something like that. And the photo that was used on the front page of the newspaper was a photo of Michael Keaton. So, you know, you can't, obviously you're not going to get Michael Keaton to do this. I mean,
right,
it'd be awesome if he would, but let's be realistic here. You're not going to get Michelle Pfeiffer to come do a return as Catwoman on this, you know, but
Jack Nicholson
to at least acknowledge this is fucking awesome, man. This is exciting. Like, I'm like you though. It is getting to a point though where how can they even possibly land this? Like,
yeah,
there are going to be so many moving parts with this. How do you pull it off and have it be satisfying? Because
can we just get an entire half a season of this?
I know, because with each of these announcements, my expectations keep getting higher, mm-hmm, and it's reaching a point where it's going to be difficult to make it good, let alone make it where it lives up to my expectations. So we'll see, I guess.
Well, you see, Nick, in the beginning, there was the monitor. And there was also the anti-monitor.
That's right. And the monitor was against the anti-monitor because reasons.
Because they were the opposites of one another. And then the anti-monitor created the antimatter universe. And the monitor, mm-hmm, created the matter universe, presumably. And then they, you know, they fought. And here we are. Well, I can't think of any better segue, Nick, to our next segment. It's a segment known the world over as... Watching.
Watching. What you be watching?
What you been watching?
Well, they're back. Ours.
We want to cover that first or cover something else first?
Let's cover that first and then move on to the other thing.
Okay.
Our stories are back.
They are.
On the CW. And unfortunately, I'm already off to a rip-roaring start, Nick.
Yeah.
I'm two shows.
You got to get caught up because you're going to be so far behind when Crisis gets here.
Oh, I know. I got to take a weekend to watch Black Lightning. You do too, though. You haven't watched Black Lightning.
Oh, contraire, my friend.
Oh, really?
I have finished Black Lightning Season 2.
Really?
And not only that, I've watched Episode 1 of Black Lightning Season 3.
This working from home business... I need to get in on this. How does one get in on that gimmick?
You just say, hey, I'm going to work from home. And they say, oh, okay. And then you just do that.
And then you watch Black Lightning. Hours.
While you work.
Well, what are your thoughts, Nick?
Oh, Black Lightning Season 2. I dropped out last season after the bizarre, like, warring factions in the woods, star-crossed lover, Romeo and Juliet-inspired two-part episode. I don't even remember which episodes those were. So I think I had like seven, eight episodes to watch. And the back half of that season was much better than the front half of the season. And it's also a show, I think, because of the way it's paced. It's a little bit slower paced than most of the other CW shows. It's not as over the top and comic booky. It doesn't really have a villain of the week type format. So I think it's one that lends itself better to binge watching anyway. So yeah, I enjoyed it. And I don't want to say too much because, you know, you're obviously you know, follow up on it at some point. I will say, really bad CGI later in the season as they get ready to introduce the Jennifer's alter ego of Lightning. Really, really, really bad CGI. But other than that, no real complaints. sets up season three for an interesting direction. And the first episode of season three was indeed interesting. So I'm looking forward to see where they go from here. Looks like they are steadily expanding the scope of Black Lightning and possibly teasing certain supergroups from the comics.
Very cool. Well, I also have not watched the season premiere of Supergirl yet, but I understand that you have, Nick, and that you've learned some valuable lessons about the importance of journalism.
Yes. Once again, you know, I always love it when Supergirl promises to have episodes that are heavily with, you know, laying it on thick with their journalism-based storylines. And this season, we're going to learn all about the importance of real journalism versus clickbait. And it's already led to several eye-rolling scenes in just the first episode alone. Got a new character running around. They are continuing to develop the Kara and Lana Luthor or Lena Luthor dynamic, which is very interesting. I have no idea where that's going. So ups and downs for Supergirl thus far, but overall good enough, I suppose.
Yes. Usually with Supergirl's message episodes, I find that the message is good, as it is in this case regarding true journalism versus clickbait, and it's the delivery that really lacks.
Yes.
Well, let's get on to the ones that I did watch this week, because first of all, we had the premiere, the series premiere of Batwoman, much anticipated by both of the hard-traveling fanboys. This was a series that would introduce us to Ruby Riott as Kate Kane. Well, not introduce us. We met her.
Ruby Riott.
We met her last year. Ruby Rose, sorry. Ruby Riott.
That would be better if Ruby Riott was Batwoman.
Ruby Rose is Batwoman, who we met last season that they did the
Elseworlds. Last crossover was Elseworlds, yeah.
And so this is her origin. This is her pilot episode.
Yes, this takes place presumably a couple years. I don't know what, some undetermined amount of time prior to Elseworlds.
And I gotta say, Nick, that for the premiere episode of Batwoman, it's okay.
It was all right, yeah. It does feel very much like early Arrow, with the interior monologue and, like, you know, kind of laying it on thick in some areas, and just even early Arrow, if you remember, early Arrow threw a lot of characters at us right from the jump, and we were just kind of having to pick them up, and you know, a lot of them were very thin early on because they were only getting so much screen time that you didn't really have a lot of time to give them a lot of nuance. You had to kind of put, you know, certain aspects of their character way out there, way out in front, so that people would have something to hook onto, and that feels a little bit like this here as well. And so maybe that's a good thing. If the comparison I'm drawing most directly is early Arrow eventually found its footing and became great. I mean, no really good show is fully realized from the start, pretty much.
Yeah.
So
of all the CW shows, I think Flash is the only one that really, like, just hit a home run with its first episode and never looked back, you know.
But it also had the benefit of you know, the two Arrow episodes, because remember it was a two-parter that he had, you know, an extensive backdoor pilot rather than this, which she was only in the one episode and was only in like 20 minutes of that. So, you know, overall it was okay, but I feel like there's enough here that it will get better as it goes along.
I agree. I like Ruby Rose as not Ruby Riott, who is a wrestler. I like Ruby Rose as Batwoman.
I like her too.
Yeah, she's very good. She's just injured right now, but I like Ruby Rose as Batwoman. The only thing I would say is there were times when I thought her accent was bleeding in. I don't know if you noticed that, Nick.
A little bit.
But yeah, there were times when her Australian accent was leaking in.
I like that. I like that Rachel Scarston as Alice too.
Not bad. And you know, it worked in there. I will tell you the thing that I hope goes away: the
interior monologue.
Well, the interior monologues, which was the same thing with Arrow early on. They dropped that after a few episodes. Mm-hmm. However, the other thing is those flashback sequences looked awful to me. Like, that effect that they used on him, it looked like something that you would have seen in a low-budget indie horror movie in, like, 1999. Like, something like Razorblade Smile or something. Like, it was – I don't know, man. It looked – or like Walker.
like when you would get those slow motion moments on Walker Texas Ranger where something dramatic would be happening and it would show this slow motion event taking place, and then Walker steps in from off frame and delivers this well-timed jeans clad spin kick. You know, it was like that, and I was like, God, that's really corny. However, the twist at the end of the episode was really cool. I like finding out about that information about Alice and her connection to Kate. So I'm very intrigued to see where that goes. And I thought after a rough first couple of scenes in terms of dialogue, I thought Doug Ray Scott as her dad is a good choice. And so I'm intrigued to see the family dynamics over the course of the season and how they play out.
Absolutely.
Then let's move on to the season premiere of The Flash, which introduced us to their version of an old Flash comics favorite from the 80s, Chunk, Chester P. Runk. And, you know, it's interesting. My mom was not very high on this episode. She was very low on it. I actually liked it a lot. I thought it was really good. What say you, Nick? Where do you fall on I thought it was a nice reset of the season. I thought it dealt in an unexpected way with the events of last year, so they're not just brushing them under the table like sometimes happens in the follow-up seasons. Barry and Iris are feeling the loss of their daughter, Nora. And, you know, the monitor showed up and messed shit up. I also really like that Cisco is no longer Vibe. I like the fact that he's back to being the tech guy again. Like, it kind of reminded me of season one, which is still my favorite season of The Flash. So, but what did you make of this episode, Nick?
Somewhere in the middle of you and your mother. I liked it fine. It wasn't a great start. I think that what was the character's name on Heroes? Damn it!
Oh, Mohinder.
Mohinder is not the most. His performance here in this episode wasn't great. Kind of wooden. Over the explicitly evil from the jump.
Yes, that really surprised me for a couple of reasons. Number one, he's a good actor. He was great on Heroes, I thought, anyway, at least in season one, which is the only Heroes season that happened, as we all know. And also, I thought the promise of this character that the producers have been talking about was that he was going to be an ambiguous character that was going to be like not really an evil guy for evil's sake, but that's out to help people. But in this episode, yes, he's out to help people, but he's also clearly evil.
Yes. So yeah, that I don't really dig the whole like Caitlin talking to herself so that she and Killer Frost
can
come together. That whole aspect. But Cisco was good. Barry was good. Barry and Iris, their dynamic's always good. Getting Ralph back,
good.
You know, all that stuff's good.
And Caitlin is really good with what she does. I just don't think – I think that story's been played out a lot.
Yes,
with her and Taylor Frost. But she's great, you know, and yeah.
Plus, I wonder for all these shows – Arrow excluded, obviously, because Arrow is kind of in a different boat because it's a shortened season and they're very clearly counting down to the end of the show. How are these shows going to handle the fact that – you can't really – this is even more so than a normal crossover. You can't really do much building towards the back half of your season yet because you've got this major thing coming in just like 7-8 episodes. So are we going to experience this kind of just feeling of spinning your wheels and stalling to get to crisis? I don't know.
We might feel
– this episode for compared to most of the other season premieres felt – a little slower in that regard. So I'm wondering if that might be if we might see pacing issues.
We might get a feeling of spin the wheel, make the deal.
Oh.
But, you know,
which is never gimmicked.
Right, of course. But, you know, the interesting thing there, Nick, is it in some ways it's kind of mirroring comics at the time because as all the comics in DC were coming out building into the crisis originally, you know, they were telling their own stories, but there were these kind of ancillary events happening, weird things happening that were affecting them. And ultimately, of course, it culminates in this big event that sort of upends all of their stuff. And then there were those comics that were kind of stuck in limbo, that were still trying to tell their own story while Crisis was going on. So it's going to be interesting to watch. It's so bold and so risky of them to do this. Let's hope it pays off. Well, let's get to that other item, Nick. that we were going to talk about, and that is the movie that is right now sweeping the world. It is breaking records. It is Warner Brothers' top grossing movie of the year, I think, to this point. Certainly super or comic book movie of the year. And it is also a hotbed of controversy in a lot of regards. It is Todd Phillips and Joaquin Phoenix's new movie, Joker. I have viewed it. I saw it this past weekend. Nick, I believe you saw it on, what was it, opening night? Or
no, it was last week, last Friday.
That's right. Both of us saw it this past weekend. And, you know, the movie's under fire from some critics. It's being hailed and praised by other critics. And after seeing it, Nick, and after reflecting on it for recording this on a Tuesday, I saw it on a Sunday. After reflecting on it for a couple days, I can't stop thinking about this movie, man. I'm the more I think about it, I think I loved it. I think it was great. Am I way out of line here?
No, I don't think so. Before we talk about the movie, let's talk about the aforementioned criticism that you mentioned. I have an issue with the way the discussion has been framed around this movie, because it feels like those who have gone out of their way to criticize the movie, most of them aren't even actually criticizing the movie. They are criticizing what they fear society's response will be to the movie.
Right.
And that's not the movie's issue. No, that's not the fault of the filmmakers. That's not the fault of the actors. I mean, like, you know, and I understand that these are over-the-top examples, that they're so over-the-top that nobody could take them seriously. But, Greg, you've mentioned before your first theatrical experience was going and seeing Alex Murphy get blown to literal smithereens and then rebuilt into RoboCop.
Yes.
And you felt no great desire to go out and blow someone apart with guns so they would become a robot.
Absolutely like, not. No.
The two movies I saw the most as a kid, more than any other, were The Silence of the Lambs and Scarface, and I felt the need to neither make skin suits out of women nor become a drug dealer. Like, I understand that you can have issues with subject material, but to evaluate a film based entirely on how it's
interpreted by others,
on how you fear that others will interpret it, or to evaluate a film based entirely on what you think it says about society and that not lining up with your own personal views, that's not really film criticism.
No.
That is expecting the film to be
film
a mirror for you.
That's looking for films that tell you what you want to hear and what you want to know. And also the other aspect of this is I don't believe we can go down that slippery slope of blaming art for how people interpret it, because then we won't have any art. We won't have any of the art that we love. Because remember, Charles, as I know it's bullshit, I know that it was garbage from the get-go, but Charles Manson, remember, blamed the murders of the Sharon Tate and her friends and family, and blamed all the horrendous actions of his cult on the Beatles song Helter Skelter, which is about an amusement park ride. The song Helter Skelter, I don't know how you can listen to it and actually think that it's anything other than a song about nonsense. It's a wonderful song. And is Paul McCartney responsible for what Charles Manson did in some way because he made a loud song? I don't think so. And similarly, you know, the guy that the Dark Knight Rises shooter who claimed to be inspired by the Joker in the Dark Knight. Is Christopher Nolan responsible for that shooting because of how he portrayed the Joker in that movie?
No. And just because you run the risk of these people taking the wrong message doesn't mean that we shouldn't have movies like this, because what is being lost again in this is people are taking issue with the message of this film, but the problem is this film says some things about society that a lot of people believe to be true.
Yep.
And it says things about the way we deal with mental illness as a society that are kind of undoubtedly true, that you can't really deny on a certain level, that mental illness in this country is under evaluated. It's understaffed. It's underfunded in many cases. So all that, let's just get that out front. I think the criticism of this film surrounding this film's perceived message, which I don't think it has
that big of a message, honestly.
Yeah, agreed.
Is overblown and bullshit. So now, the film itself. It's outstanding. I mean, it's well acted. It's well crafted. It's tense from the open to the close. And it makes narrative choices really throughout the film, but especially in the back third, that assuage a lot of the concerns I had going into it, as it, in terms of it being an adaptation of the Joker's origin, where it introduces a level of ambiguity that I feel is necessary, that is absolutely vital and essential to telling any sort of Joker origin story. So all that being said, I mean, you and I both talked about how much we didn't know if this movie should exist. Mm-hmm. I think the narrative they chose to tell is such that you can – this. I'm willing to accept this as a possible version of the Joker origin story, even though my reading of the film is that I don't know how much of it is actually true. How about that?
Yeah. And I'll be the first to man up and say it. We were wrong about this movie, as I suspected could have been the case from the get-go, and think I said as much on the show, that watch this thing come out and be amazing and blow us away. It blew me away. I'll be honest with you. I watched this movie, and I was not expecting it to dig into my brain or to dig into my heart as much as it did. And I left that theater asking myself a lot of uncomfortable questions, thinking about this movie more than I've thought about a comic book movie, honestly, in a long, long time. Not to say that this is the best comic book movie that I've ever seen. I'm not going to go that far. But it made me think in a way that comic book movies rarely do. And not just fantasizing about what could come next, but thinking about what it meant. What really happened? What did I just, to quote JR, what did we just see? Like, there's so many interesting choices that this movie makes. And to your point, ambiguity, number one among them. Because to me, this aligns with the greatest Joker stories that I've seen. Whether it be in comics, like The Killing Joke, whether it be on Batman the Animated Series, The Laughing Fish, whether it be in The Dark Knight. This was a classic Joker story, but also a story that goes beyond the Joker and could have been about anyone, really, until it takes some turns along the way. To your point, Nick, I don't know if the whole thing is BS. I don't know if parts of it are BS. I don't know if almost all of it is BS. It is a really well-done narrative. I encourage any of our listeners to go out and watch this. I don't think that it will be triggering or anything like that. I think it will be very impactful, and because it was to me. It's an interesting movie that doesn't provide easy answers for anything, provides a lot of different perspective villains, and ultimately, some of the biggest concerns I had, including the issue of feeling sympathy for the Joker, this movie makes choices that assuage those concerns for me. At least in the way that they were executed here. I loved it.
Yeah, pretty much agreed.
Well, with all that being said, it's also been a big time in the world of the Graps, Nick.
For fuck's sake.
And you know that it's time, by looking at the sundial on my windowsill, it's informing me that it's time for the Wrestling Minute. Oh my gosh, a second episode of AEW Dynamite in the books, Nick, and I think
it was better than the first one.
Yep.
I think it was a lot better than the first one, honestly. Like, the first one had good matches and stuff. This one, you got to kind of, I think you got more of an idea of what their approach to storytelling is going to be. And I think that is the key. Like, they can talk about all day long that the focus is going to be in the ring, and absolutely that's a great goal to have, and it should be the defining feature of your product. But what's going to keep people coming back week to week is how you tell stories using what happens in the ring and how you branch things and seed things from week to week. And I think this week we got a better look at what that's going to look like and what their approach is going to be. I thought it was an outstanding effort.
I totally agree. There's lots of places to get great wrestling right now. What AEW can do is meld that great wrestling with great storytelling, with great American wrestling storytelling.
And I thought that's what we got here. We got an outstanding opening match with the Young Bucks against Private Party, which was a coming out party of sorts for Private Party. An amazing opener with a genuinely shocking result. And then you segue that right into one of the promos of the year in wrestling, which was Chris Jericho introducing his new heel stable, the Inner Circle, doing an amazing job, as really only Jericho can do these days, of getting everyone's character over within the group, establishing Santana and Ortiz as the sort of streetwise gangsters in the group, establishing Sammy Guevara as the Spanish sex god, this matinee idol who looks good and is flashy, and then of course establishing Jake Hager as the muscle of the group, the guy that stands in the background scowling and dares anyone to cross them. And I thought it was an amazing promo and really stole the night in wrestling. And I've still actually have not watched NXT yet, which I need, not a commentary on NXT, because I want to watch Walter and Kushida so bad. I'm going to have to get to it maybe tonight after we finish this recording. But what did you make of NXT?
I haven't watched it.
So we're in the same boat on there. I got to watch it. I want to see that Walter and Kushida real bad. And then Raw and SmackDown, of course, have their drafts now in the books.
War rooms.
Yes. Now, Nick, which war room was your favorite?
Well, I don't know. I think the Fox one is pretty good because it had a Fox football robot just up and walking around in real life, even though it's a CGI creation. There was also a guy with a laptop, but his laptop was constantly on the Peacock screensaver, so no work was actually being done. One of them had a guy in clown makeup. One of them had a couple of overly enthusiastic Asian ladies. One of them featured people running around in a circle doing high fives and stuff. So, yeah.
Doing the Mike Tenay gif from TNA. Yep.
So, you know, WWE is really looking for that real sport. You know, they wanted to give it that real sports feel on Fox, and I feel like doing these ultra-realistic looks at what real-life draft war rooms look for, like, for professional sports teams, put them on the right track.
Absolutely. They're super realistic, super believable. As you know, whenever you watch the NFL draft, you see a lot of that happening. You see people in outfits. You see people high-fiving after every single pick, running around the room, throwing stuff against the wall when they when they fail to draft the Miz or whoever it may be.
You also when you're picking a single wrestler, you also need approximately 40 people sitting around a giant conference table to really be in on the decision.
And it's and given that you are submitting like five picks at once, getting upset about individual picks is very odd.
It really is strange. But
anyway, the drafts happened. It's really honestly lame. Probably the worst draft they've ever done. But there were a couple of moves. Most people just stayed on the shows they were already on. But the biggest ones, Charlotte to Raw.
That's interesting because so they put Charlotte and Becky on one show and Sasha and Bayley on one show. Yep. And the problem is Sasha and Bayley are both heels and Becky and Charlotte are both faces. So, well, I guess Charlotte technically could be either, but
she's more of a twin.
That was an odd move, is what I'll say.
Well, it was done, I think, because of the relationship, the backstage relationships, because they moved moved Aleister Black to Raw at Paul Heyman's behest. And as a result, he's married to Zelina Vega, who had to move to Raw, who is tied to Andrade, who had to move to Raw, who is tied to Charlotte. So it really put them in a unique situation. And then SmackDown's big acquisition will be Bray Wyatt and Braun Strowman, right?
God, I just realized they gave Heyman Andrade, Cedric Alexander, and Buddy Murphy. So he'll have fun with that. And then, Lesnar and Bray Wyatt. Yeah, those are the two big ones there. And let's not forget late breaking news that Alexa Bliss and Nikki Cross went over to SmackDown in exchange for cash considerations and future draft considerations.
Oh, yes. My God, players to be named later. Now, in all seriousness, how fun is it going to be to see Paul Heyman work with pretty much all of these young workhorses? Because Raw now is established as the work rate brand, and SmackDown is established as the star power brand. No knock on guys like the great Daniel Bryan's there, New Day. But you know what I'm saying? They've got these young, unproven workhorses like Buddy Murphy and like Cedric. So it's going to be real interesting to see what Paul does to get him over.
Absolutely.
Well, I guess that's it. I mean, I can't think of anything else to talk about here on the show, Nick. I know you teased something earlier though. Why don't you why don't you tell the folks kind of what we've got going on as a Satan gentleman works his way over here to the
table. The hard traveling fanboys, as always, have our thumb and forefinger firmly on the pulse of pop culture. And you know, there's a young lady who is just blowing up on the pop charts, well, the rap charts, the Billboard Hot 100s, and all that stuff, just setting social media afire. So we thought it was time to let this young lady, known as, I believe it's Lizzo, be reimagined in our own Jim Ross way. So here to do a little Lizzo is WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross. Jim, I know you're excited about this.
Well, I'm not familiar with Lizzo. I am familiar with Tom Izzo, coach of Michigan State Spartans, hell of a basketball program, by the way. And you know, I know him pretty good. We've been friends a while. And when I heard that there was a person named Lizzo, I thought, well, what the hell? I'll give it a shot. I'll give it a try. I can't claim to be that familiar with the tune, but I'm going to give it a try based on the lyrics provided for me right now. Why men great till they gotta be great? Woo! I just took a DNA test. Turns out that I'm 100% that bitch. Even when I'm crying crazy, yeah, I got boy problems. That's the human in me. Bling, bling, then I solve them. That's the goddess in me, Alexa Bliss. You could have had a bad bit, non-committal, help you with your career just a little. You're supposed to hold me down, but you're holding me back. And that's the sound of me not calling you back. Why men great till they got to be great in the square circle? Don't text me, tell it straight to my face. If you're a fire my ass, then fire my ass. Best friend sat me down in the salon chair. Shampoo press, get you out of my hair. Fresh photos on the bomb lighter. New man on the Minnesota Vikings. Not like Brock Lesnar, who had a motorcycle accident that derailed his career at Minnesota Vikings. Truth hurt. Needed something more exciting. Bum, bum, be, bum, ba, bum, bing, bum, bum, bay. You break my heart? Oh, that breaks my damn heart. Oh, I'm playing the world's tiniest violin. I like that joke with Henny Youngman used, that you thought you ever had it. Oh, no, you ain't from a star. Hey, I'm glad you're back with your bit. I mean, who would ever want to hide this? I will never, ever, 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 ever be your side chick. I put the sing in single. I ain't worried about a ring on my finger unless it is a national championship ring for my Oklahoma Sooners. You can tell your friend, shoot your shot when you see him. It's okay, he's already in my DMs at jail. BBQ. Why men great till they got to be great? Don't text me, tell it straight to my face. Best friend sat me down in the salon chair. Shampoo press, get you out of my hair. Fresh photos with the bomb light in. There is a new man on the Minnesota Vikings. It's their coach, Mike Zimmer. Truth hurts. Needed something more exciting. Bomb, bomb, be bomb, be bomb, bomb, bay. I'ma hit you back in a minute. Listen, I don't play tag, you son of a bitch. I've been in. We don't fuck with lies. We don't do goodbyes. We just keep pushing it like, ay, ay, ay. I'ma hit you back in a minute. I don't play tag, you son of a bitch. I've been in. We don't fuck with lies. We don't do goodbyes. We just keep pushing like, ay, 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 ay. Why men great till they got to be great? Do not text me. Tell it straight to my face. My best friend sat me down in a salon chair. Shampoo press, get you out of my hair. Fresh photos with the bomb lighting. New man on the Minnesota Vikings. Kirk Cousins. Truth hurts. Needed something more exciting. Bomb, bomb, be bomb. Dumb, bum, bay.
Bar traveling, 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 bar traveling Wars.